You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Forward, punch!
What I really want to do is play Gershwin's own notes.
I'm not in the business to deceive. I'm only in the business to recreate.
Hello, I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Today we'll explore why we choose to recreate artifacts from the past on canvas, in architecture, in the concert hall, even on the battlefield. We'll hear from cellist Yo-Yo Ma.
I think there is such joy in noodling.
And my special guest in the studio is New Yorker critic and author Adam Gopnik.
The difference between art and kitsch is largely measured out in ruin.
All that and more coming up here in Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. November 11th is Veterans Day, Armistice Day if you're my mother. And on the Mall in Washington, D.C. this weekend, they're supposed to break ground for yet another new memorial. The World War II Memorial. And like every other memorial put up in Washington during the last two decades, people have fought and are still fighting over where the memorial should be built and how it should look. 20 years ago, for the Vietnam War Memorial, the designer Maya Lin had imagined a black granite V sunk into the Mall in Washington, minimal and somber. Conservatives at the time saw the plan as another example of the liberal cultural conspiracy. Are you now or have you ever been an abstractionist? They demanded something traditional and figurative. And 2 years after the memorial wall was dedicated, they got what they thought they wanted. Three life-sized, realistic statues of infantrymen. I say they thought they wanted, because once the Vietnam Memorial Wall was open, and once tens of millions of Americans made their pilgrimages and experienced the space and stroked the wall, who failed to be moved? Go there today, and it's not liberals or art snobs ignoring the banal statues in favor of the magnificent, heartbreaking black wall. A tragic memorial for a tragic episode, something Americans of this day and age are able to pull off deftly with conviction. Like at the extraordinary new Oklahoma City National Memorial, a field of 168 ghost chairs commemorating the lives wasted in the terrorist bombing of the federal building there. But plain old-fashioned military heroism? We have problems these days knowing what to build to memorialize that. In the debate over the World War II memorial, a few of the arguments are ideological. Some people want a more celebratory design. But the debate is mainly aesthetic, not political. And this time, I think, the opponents have got it right. The site for the World War II memorial on the Mall is wrong, both too intrusive and too small. Just 7 measly acres to commemorate a great and noble war. And worse, the design is deeply unimaginative. Abstract, but a kind of dull Soviet-style abstraction. 2 giant arches and 56 granite columns surrounding a pool. It's a pity. Elsewhere in our culture just now, we have arrived at a moment of extreme appreciation for the victory of the Second World War. A kind of spontaneous national standing ovation. The movie Saving Private Ryan did not flinch from depicting the screeching bloody nightmare of combat, even as it glorified that most extremely old-fashioned of old-fashioned virtues, doing one's duty.
Private James Ryan is well, and at this very moment, on his way home from European battlefields. Reports from the front indicate James did his duty in combat with great courage and steadfast dedication.
And The Greatest Generation has sold its millions of copies not because its author is a TV star.
As I walk the beaches of Normandy on the 40th and 50th anniversaries of D-Day, I first began to realize how they had shaped my life.
But because it provides a way for us finally to salute the achievement of our forebears, of people like my father in the Philippines and my father-in-law in Normandy. These days, when it comes to celebrating straight-ahead military heroism, we're more comfortable with memorials in the form of software, a film, a book, then with old-fashioned marble and bronze memorial hardware. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Today in Studio 360, we begin a series of profiles of cultural mentors with a tribute to the author, philosopher, and octogenarian Maxine Green, who has been inspiring arts teachers in New York for almost 60 years, including the poet and storyteller David Gonzalez.
When I went to her house for the first time, my feet shuffled with the shy, tentative steps of a pupil going up the mountain, okay, the elevator, to the great master. After all, I had heard her speak a couple of times, and I had seen the way that the poobahs of arts education clamored around her at conferences. This was Maxine Green, the philosopher. But at our visit, she peppered me with questions about my work, how I made choices, how this poem evolved, how that story connected to my own life, making me feel, well, interesting. But more importantly, she made me feel valued and even needed. The talk then went far and wide into art and education, not about how art can fit into the curriculum or help achieve the new standards, but how art awakens the senses, gives voice, and creates empathic people.
Without imagination, there's no empathy. You know, that because imagination allows you to see through somebody else's eyes, to reach beyond. You know, I think that's true, but I think imagination is more than empathy. I think it opens these spaces, you know.
Opening spaces, it sounds so, like, spacey, but in the moment of encounter with a work of art, it is good language. Spaces where insight happens, spaces where compassion is stirred, spaces where wonder and outrage can be born. Here she is in action at Teachers College, a course on aesthetics.
What strikes you about that? But certainly you see his fascination with clouds. He does, so many of his paintings focus on different kinds of clouds. As you could tell, prepares in some way for the Impressionists. And look at the trees. The trees are almost in movement. It is, again, the kind of painting that Constable himself said was made possible because of memory, because of
her students
memory,
love her, and people image, who meet her want more. She's got fans everywhere. Maxine is, she's like the Dylan of aesthetic education.
She can make connections intuitively between things she has read, between theater she has seen, between a piece of music she has heard, and something she read in the New York Times, or Harry Potter. In a way that no one I have ever met or ever read does. She's not a philosopher in isolation. She's a philosopher in touch with her world.
That was Madeline Holzer, poet and director of program development at the Lincoln Center Institute for Art Education, where Maxine is philosopher in residence. But mostly she resides in the classroom, where her style is punchy and personal.
We needed somebody, Jackson Pollock or somebody, to break it. So you'd find
I try to teach that way, you know, and I'm still teaching, which is silly, but it's partly trying. I'll never learn it. I'm trying to teach as somebody who says, come in here. It's exciting. It's wonderful. But then I always tell them, you know, that I believe in your freedom to decide for yourself, but secretly I want you to be just like me. So I say, you have to fight that. You know, I tell the students they have to fight that. Because I'm not out to impose. I'm out to get them upset, you know.
I like that. Bringing teachers, young people, and artists together, leading us deeper into the beauty and power of art, and then getting us upset, rankled, agitated. Maxine titled one of her books, Releasing the Imagination, Essays on Education, the Arts, and Social Change. One of the main themes is how art opens experience. Check her out. When we see more and hear more through the opening of perception that the arts give us, it is not only that we lurch, if only for a moment, out of the familiar and the taken for granted, but that new avenues for choosing and for action may open in our experience. We may gain a sudden sense of new beginnings. That is, we may take an initiative in the light of possibility. An initiative in the light of possibility. Art is not ornamental, not entertaining, not nice. Art, according to Maxine, energizes human potential. Well, okay, art can be ornamental and nice, but in the end, I'd like to think we make art to wake up, to take notice of our world, to sharpen our sensuous experience of life, and to imagine our way toward greater meaning and community. So, for Maxine Green, a poem of tribute. It's called The Blue Guitar, after Wallace Stevens. The blue guitar strains to be heard. Tears slip from its sound hole. Its grief and jubilance are quiet and close to the wood. You have to make a choice to risk everything to get close to the grain, to hear it. The blue guitar strings quiver with fine truth, and those who hear these tones know that they too must sing out, whether they are heard or not. It is such a song.
You know, you're not resting, if you can imagine. I like always tell people, I am what I am not yet.
For Studio 360, I'm David Gonzalez.
Maxine Green's latest book is Variations on a Blue Guitar, the Lincoln Center Institute Lectures on Aesthetic Education. She continues to teach at Columbia University and at the Lincoln Center Institute in New York. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. On Design for the Real World today, we take a look at something that's almost certainly sitting in one of your desk drawers right now, and which, if you're like me, you use 10 times a day. Here is a deconstruction of the Post-it note from Museum of Modern Art design curator Paola Antonelli.
What I find particularly interesting and what I think transforms the Post-it from an engineering mistake discovery into a piece of design is the thought that went into making it square and yellow. The square doesn't let you be superfluous, doesn't let you go on too long with your thoughts. It's a perfect containment. A rectangle suggests that you can go away into the direction that is the longest on the paper. A square really tells you, look at the center, straighten your thoughts, focus the issues, and be short and to the point. And yellow is the color of alert to remind you what needs to be done, to remind you of what is urgent.
Do you have an idea for something you'd like us to explore on Design for the Real World? You can let us know about it through our website. Visit studio360.org.
She just goes a little mad sometimes.
She just goes a little mad sometimes.
We all go a little mad sometimes.
We all go a little mad sometimes. Haven't you?
Haven't you?
Yes.
We've just heard a bit from the original 1960 version of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, followed by the same scene from director Gus Van Sant's recent slavishly faithful remake of Psycho. Today in Studio 360, we're going to look at why we love to recreate pieces of our cultural past in every medium imaginable. I'm Kurt Anderson, and with me to explore and try to explain this idea is the New Yorker critic and author Adam Gopnik, who has just returned to the United States after 5 years in Paris. His new book is entitled Paris to the Moon. Adam Gopnik, why do you think it is that we Americans have such a fascination with recreating chunks of our cultural past?
Well, I think you got two theories, one interesting and false probably, and one less interesting and probably true. One is that it does seem to be a kind of 30-year cycle, not just now, but generally. Think about the 1940s. Think about musicals like Meet Me in St. Louis or Take Me Out to the Ball Game or parts of Cover Girl. They all are set right around 1910, right between 1900 and 1910. So there does seem to be kind of 30-year rule of nostalgia that generally operates. That's when you locate the lost good time, is 30 years before, generally speaking, because the people who are making movies and records and so on are in their mid-40s, and that's when they had a good time. But it does seem to me there's something particularly weird about the way we relate to, not so much to the 60s. You know, it's one of those strange things. It's like punk hardly existed in the 70s, but post-punk was everything. And in the same way, you know, the 60s, it seems to me, are less what people are haunted by than they are by the early 70s. That's really the moment when people get are obsessed by.
Now, this recycling of the recent past, which has, I think, gotten more kind of maniacal with shorter cycles in the last 30 years, and we've been stuck in a kind of cultural cul-de-sac, really. But there's also, I think, something that's been going on for the last 25 or 30 years in architecture, in music, in all kinds of realms, of this looking back for 100 years or 200 years and this sort of clinging on to the classical, broadly defined, and reviving any decade or any half century that seems to be remotely current in its resonances.
Well, you know, in music, in a weird way, I think the two things are related. And in this way, that is that think of the early music movement that's become so huge. I mean, I remember at one point, I think Christopher Hogwood, the British conductor who leads the Academy of Ancient Music, an early music group, was selling more records than Pavarotti. But if you think about it, what is that music like? I think that music is so popular in large part because it sounds like the Beatles. That is to say, it sounds like the Beatles in their Baroque period. It's very lightly scored. One of my favorite recordings of the last 20 years is the one that Joshua Rifkin did of the Bach Mass in B minor with only four voices, in fact. Well, kind of interesting that it's only four voices, right? And that's what our Bach is like.
That combo playing.
Yeah, exactly.
Mass in B minor.
Exactly. And I think that sound, that kind of lightly scored version of Baroque is one that's very agreeable to people like myself. I'm totally obsessed with it. Who were raised on lightly scored music, who were raised on three guitars and a drummer. And I think I don't think it's accidental in that way. And I think there's a huge divide, I've noticed, in fact, but attitudes towards the early music movement. And that it comes about if people are over 50, genuinely can't stand it. They just don't like it. They can't make any sense of it. They really feel that it's a violation of everything that they like about classical music. They feel.
Because it's stripped down and kind of minimalist in a way.
It's stripped down, it's minimalist, and I think they see it as being it's anti-romantic. And those of us whose idea of romance depended on the stripped down and the musically simplified, find that the most romantic version of Baroque music that you can find. And I think I think in a weird way those two things go together, and that Christopher Hogwood is Handel for people who listen to Sgt. Pepper.
Another thing that strikes me about this sort of revivalist impulse in this country in the last 30 years or so is that it often begins as a kind of smirk, as a joke. Postmodern architecture in the 70s was, let's have columns and pediments and all of these funny architectural gestures of the past, and very quickly became a serious, earnest pursuit. And you see that even now, I think, with the revival of 70s stuff from the Beastie Boys and Beck. It begins as kind of a funny, smirky idea of, a 70s revival that perhaps began 10 or 12 years ago. But we look at the culture around us now, the 70s revival has almost nothing comic about it.
Well, I think that's right. It's like the new Charlie's Angel movie, right? I mean, it's supposed to be meta-jiggle, but it's not really meta-jiggle. It's just jiggle, basically. It's how it grabs you.
Well, this week, as you know, Adam, we're going to be talking about a pianist who meticulously reproduces Gershwin's performances, and about new urban neighborhoods and suburbs that are based on the old layouts of old towns and cities, the so-called new urbanism movement. Plus, Yo-Yo Ma will talk to us about playing Bach on a cello from Bach's time. I'm Kurt Anderson. Stay with me and my guest, Adam Gopnik, as Studio 360 continues on PRI Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. My special guest today is the New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik. American woman, mama, let me be. Don't come hanging around my door. Now there we cut back and forth between the authentic American Woman by The Guess Who from Our Youths, and Lenny Kravitz's cover version, popular cover version.
I have
a
particular inflection that too, because you have to remember the Guess Who, like me, is Canadian. We're Canadian, in fact. And so that song was was meant to be a declaration of Canadian independence, right? How lousy American women are as opposed to Canadian women, like my wife. But in fact, it was deeply embarrassing to everybody in Canada because it was so what the British would call naff. It was so gauche. It was so gauche as a song and so gauche that they would be our best rock band, the Guess Who. In fact, that everybody in Canada, who I knew anyway, was totally embarrassed by
this. This sounds like Canadian revisionism to me, but...
You have to have a history to have revisionism, Kurt. So that's what we're missing.
But our cover versions of relatively recent pop songs and sampling and that kind of pastiche nostalgia, is that born of the same impulse that gives rise to architects who create absolutely accurate versions of 17th or 18th century buildings? Is that all part of the same kind of millennial nostalgic impulse, do you think?
Well, you know, people say so. They say we live in a pastiche culture and so on. That's a familiar thing. I really do think that there are, as with everything in life, there are wings to it. I mean, Prince Charles's desire to have little 18th century villages remade in England is clearly different from whoever you want. Michael Graves' desire to put a pediment on top of the Whitney. One is...
arguably bad conservatism, yes, and one is good conservatism.
Yes, and both are different from the desire to restore Grand Central, it seems to me, which comes from a different sort of historical respect for history. And I think that they run on very different kinds of energy, it seems to me, even if they end up making remarkably similar things. And you have to be sort of a trained observer to know which one you're engaged with at any one time, in fact.
But the fact is, I think, that the great general lay audience tends to like all of those things, whether they are kind of fundamentalist Prince Charles versions of the past or preservations of a 100-year-old building or something in between. The people,
yeah,
because like
that's right, I think. And they don't need to know whether it's meant ironically or sincerely. They just like what they're looking at.
Speaking of that blur between irony and sincerity, Sarah Fischko, a producer at WNYC, took an ironic look at a few very earnest artists who seem to take all of their inspiration from the past.
With Madame Tussauds Wax Museum now open here in Times Square, it's hard not to think about issues of reality, illusion, recreation, and celebrity. For example, I'm not really in Times Square. I just tried to make you think I was by yelling into the mic with sound effects in the background. Maybe you even guessed that. But in any case, you may have enjoyed the illusion or even the failure of the illusion. Madame Tussauds Wax Museum, by the way, for the uninitiated among you, features lifelike, fully costumed wax figures of famous people of the past and present, positioned to be not only viewed, but photographed by you and your loved ones. You and Arnold Schwarzenegger, for example, in one photo. Your son posing with his sports hero in another. Your fiancé with a wax reproduction of Eleanor Roosevelt. They told him, "Don't you ever come around here. Don't wanna see." Even though everybody knows they're wax figures, it's still better to be standing next to Michael Jackson in wax than not at all. Which leads me to a fellow everyone calls Patch.
I want to be a great painter. And the only way to learn how to be a great painter is to copy and learn from the masters.
Onofrio Pacioni was one of the great advertising art directors of the 1960s. After that, a stellar commercial photographer, now a fine artist. He's spent the last 9 years painting copies of artworks. He makes remarkable replicas of seminal works by the great painters.
I do Rembrandts. I've done 4 Rembrandts. I've done Modiglianis. I've done Vermeer. I got a couple of Vermeers.
But they're not, you understand, fakes, these paintings.
It's a Pacioni. It's an interpretation. It's a creative interpretation. That's what it is. I'm making a Van Gogh interpreted by Pacioni. I'm putting my own spirit into it.
Interpretation or not, Pacioni takes considerable pains to create an accurate likeness. He starts off by photographing the painting.
When I start a painting, if I'm going to copy, say, a Cézanne, I almost x-ray it. I dissect sections of it. and I make what I call color notes, and I make maybe a print, and from that I work. And as I'm painting, I love the feeling of being able to do something that's so difficult.
So I have to ask, what makes a good copy? Is the best copy the one that most closely resembles the original? Or is it the one with its own slant on the original? Or what? And Patch seems to feel he has an answer.
If you go to the Met, you'll see a copy of a Rubens by Lansdere. It's about not even a third of the size of the large one, but it's accurate in feeling and attitude and in drawing. That's what makes it good.
The works of Van Gogh, Rembrandt, Picasso, Matisse, Renoir, and absolutely everyone else, as interpreted by Onofrio Pacioni, are on display at a gallery in New Hope, Pennsylvania. All your favorite paintings are there, but Patch says he has other reasons. He's not that interested in selling.
I practically know these people. I can have lunch with them. It's like, you know, sitting around with Degas, Cézanne, Monet, and Renoir. I know what they're thinking. I know how they feel. I know what they like to eat. You pay tribute to these people, and you learn from them.
He learns, sure. But sometimes he even fools himself.
I did a Chagall, and I interpreted Chagall. You swear. It's a new Chagall. I could have pawned it off as a Chagall, but I wouldn't do that. Every painting I do, I always sign Pacioni after Rembrandt, Pacioni after Vermeer. I'm not in the business to deceive. I'm only in the business to recreate.
Recreation is the name of Jack Gibbons' game as well. The pianist recreates Gershwin, this Gershwin. The George Gershwin that would sit down at the piano and wow him at parties. In fact, Gibbons' most recent New York concert was called a Gershwin party.
He was a tremendous virtuoso and completely self-taught. Because there's the story that Rachmaninoff heard Gershwin playing in Carnegie Hall and came around to see him afterwards and was bowled over with Gershwin's piano technique. And of course, there's the cine film of Gershwin. You can see him playing and his left hand is leaping all over the place. I can give you an example. The left hand leaps up and down like this sort of thing. You start with a very large chord. You move up to a...
Gibbons, too, uses an almost X-ray-like dissection of his subject, transcribing every note from piano rolls and recordings.
I Got Rhythm, he plays the tune just with the thumb of his right hand, like this. Well, he's obviously got four fingers in the same hand that aren't doing anything, so he gives them something to do at the same time. He then puts the beats in the left hand. I feel very sort of almost religious about Gershwin, and for me, what I really want to do is play Gershwin's own notes, and that doesn't just mean the melody, I mean, it means all the harmonies and rhythms as well.
So, copying is acceptable. Maybe it's even downright popular. It's apparently satisfying to some artists and to some audiences as well. And as long as everybody knows it's a copy, everybody's happy. Recreations are okay. Among consenting adults. Which brings me to Big Bird's Orchestra. An audio tape, purchasable at your local bookstore with companion book, which is supposed to introduce very young children to the instruments.
I'm Big Bird, the conductor.
But upon examination by a grown-up, it appears as if something is rotten in Toyland. It appears as if these sounds, identified as the instruments of the orchestra, are in fact created on a synthesizer.
On the violin prairie.
If that's a violin, I'm Yasha Heifetz.
Bassoon sound deep.
Listen
long.
To what's supposed to pass as a bassoon.
And Harry on the triangle.
Even the triangle is a pale imitation. But that's not even the point. The point is there are times when only the real thing will do. Skilled artists can paint staggering replicas of great oil paintings. Wax figures, remarkably like Oprah Winfrey and Golda Meir, now animate Times Square. Musicians recapture a bit of history by mimicking the style of long-dead innovators, fine. Grown-ups agree to suspend disbelief and may have fun doing it. But come on. At least let a child hear a real violin, so he might fall in love with that sound and someday long to recreate it on, of all things, another real violin. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fischko.
I'm Kurt Anderson here in Studio 360 with the writer and critic Adam Gopnik, author of Paris to the Moon. Adam, the guy who recreates Rembrandt's and Chagall's and the charming, fascinating guy who recreates measure by measure Gershwin's playing, should we pity those people? Are they pathetic?
You know, there's a sense in which I'm always struck by it, too, that within a culture of recycling, recreation, there's a certain kind of space for very eccentric forms of personal expression. I always think, you know, this guy who does the Vermeers and Rembrandts and so on. I once wrote a story about a guy named Maxie Schachnow, who was a 7th Avenue, I think he was a factor in 7th Avenue, obsessed with Van Gogh, copying Van Gogh's. And that's what he spent all of his Sundays doing. I met him at a Sunday painter's fair once. And he became aware of the fact that the one missing work in all of Van Gogh's oeuvre was a portrait of his brother Theo, who supported him and was the great mainstay of his life, the only person who really appreciated him. And it's true that Vincent never painted a portrait of Theo. So Maxie Schachnow took it on himself to paint the missing portrait of Theo, and that became his holy grail. He was going to paint the portrait of Theo that Vincent had forgotten to paint.
So the eccentric sort of obsessive hobby actually becomes an artistic enterprise.
Yes, of an eccentric obsessive kind.
And of course, today, as technology and the kind of miracles of digital recreation make possible all kinds of blurring of the real and the fake and the authentic and the inauthentic, I think puts these kinds of impulses in a whole new context, because we can look at photographs that seem to depict a reality, a plain reality that simply never existed.
Well, even when we talk about, Big Bird's orchestra, it seems to me, as always, we put the question on, well, synthesized music. Hey, it's a guy dressed up in a bird suit pretending to be Big Bird, right? We no longer even put a question mark around Big Bird. Is that an authentic thing? As long as it's a guy dressed up in feathers, right, I think maybe he has the right to use a synthesizer.
Big Bird lives on Sesame Street, of course, which is the very model of the dense, old-fashioned urban neighborhood teeming with a sense of community, the very thing that the new urbanist movement is trying to recreate in architecture and town planning, and which we're going to talk about next. Andres Dwani is the father of new urbanism. I've been writing about and visiting the developments designed by Dwani and his wife, Elizabeth Platter-Zyberg, for 15 years. The town of Seaside in Florida is the most famous of the new urbanist projects. I spoke to Andres Dwani recently, but not to perpetrate any illusion of authenticity. He, in fact, was in Windsor, Florida, while I was here in Studio 360. Windsor is a new urbanist luxury community. And as I spoke to him, I could hear the sound of seagulls behind Andres in South Florida as he spoke.
Well, I'd say that this is a fairly typical street in Windsor. It's nice and tight. It's so small that vehicles could never, cars could never speed down this street. It's also short, so they can't pick up the speed. And the houses are right up on the street with the windows, so it's quite interesting to walk by.
Correct me if I'm wrong in my simple statement of what new urbanism is about, but it's about, I think, recovering the wisdom of town building that Americans had naturally developed over the first couple of hundred years of this country's history, and which, in your view, we sort of lost around the time of World War II.
Well, we threw it out because it was actually very viable. And the proof of that is that the older towns, for example, the Manhattan itself, to give an example, is essentially a 19th century city. The infrastructure is from the 19th century. And there are many, many places that, in fact, survive and are currently in use. And what we have is are two parallel realities in the United States. We have the pre-war urbanism, which actually many people prefer, and an increasing number, and then the suburban model of the post-World War II generation. And what we're doing is actually building the older, traditional kind of urbanism again, for all of its many virtues.
Now, when you talk about rebuilding historical neighborhood patterns, basically you're talking about houses being closer together, streets being narrower, cars parking on the street.
Mm-hmm. Streets walkable. A lot smaller, since there's a kind of priority being close to destinations, you know, being close to school, being close to the shops, being close to transit. You know, the irony of Windsor is that although it is, in fact, the least socially adventurous, or should I say sociologically adventurous of our projects, it's all rich people, it is nevertheless the most architecturally radical. We've invited dozens of architects, in fact, to come here sequentially and build the buildings.
And is that because in that way only can the towns and developments that you master plan can actually look like old towns that were done by many hands?
It's very hard to falsify variety by a single hand. And I think you can see architects desperately trying to come up with different ideas, and in the end it still looks like a project. And so there's some authentic visual variety here, but there's something else that I think is more important, which is that it's a more resilient kind of design when many hands have had a go at it. If one or two or three or, you know, four of the buildings make mistakes, you haven't built in those mistakes throughout. And there's also something else, which is that it's done sequentially. If we were to have designed all the buildings, even if they were built over time, the essential aspect would be of a single design at one point in time. But by using several architects responding to each other and so forth, you get sequence. Time, to me, as much as size and complexity, is an element of urbanism. Urbanism requires time, and it gains character by time.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik, who has also been an art critic and writer about architecture. The new urbanist movement has, since its beginning a couple of decades ago and still today, faced enormous reflexive opposition from the sort of leftist architectural academic establishment, who regard it as conservative and used to call it Reaganist. What's your feeling about that?
I haven't actually seen the towns, so I shouldn't comment on them, but that's never stopped me in the past. An absence of sight never stops a critic from talking. Responding to the general idea, why is it that I feel at least a little bit uneasy in the presence of the idea, if not in the presence of the town? I think maybe the thing is that those of us who love cities love the serendipity of cities. We love the sense that a strong element of accident has played a part in their making. You know, at the same time, I think it's not impossible to feel a little bit uneasy with the notion that you can manufacture it, that there seems to be something that resists. I'm not saying that you can't. I'm just saying we resist inside the notion of manufactured serendipity, of deliberately planned accident.
We'll continue our conversation in a minute, and we'll hear from Yo-Yo Ma about playing Baroque music on a cello from the Baroque period, and visit a Civil War battle reenactment. I'm Kurt Anderson with the author and critic Adam Gopnik here in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Those are two very different interpretations of that very familiar passage from Handel's Messiah. First one with a grand modern chorus and orchestra, the other played on original instruments and with a small chorus performing in a style that Handel probably heard himself. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik. When those two pieces of Handel played just a minute ago, Adam, Did you immediately feel as though let down, as I did, by the second early instrument one?
No, I felt just the opposite. The second one brought tears to my eyes, and the first one sounded to me like reminding me of my grandfather listening to the Texaco Opera on Saturdays. It had a certain kind of mid-40s pomposity to it, whereas the second one...
But that's Handel's Messiah. If it doesn't have pomposity and grandiosity, what is it?
Well, the second one sounds so modern because it's authentic, right? Why does the second one stir me and move me so much in a way that the first one doesn't? I wish I knew. It sounds modern for one reason, because it responds to things we like in modern music, for instance, clarity, small scale.
I've been told that you are very fond of music in addition to this particular piece of Handel, music in general played on original instruments. Is that a kind of prissy conservatism that you have?
Well, hidden? I am, of course, a prissy conservative. So that would,
and a Canadian,
Help, and that would help explain it, of course. I don't know. It's one of the things that mystifies me, and certainly mystifies my wife when I play these things. I have an obsessive relationship with that kind of music. I really love to hear it. I think it has to do with the way that it drains some of the drama from classical music and therefore makes it much more restrained and therefore, for me, much more emotional in that way. That is to say, it's modern in the way that, you know, when we love looking at Matisse drawings, one of the things we love is what's not there, in fact. And that's one of the things that modern listeners and modern viewers learn to do. That
it's reduced to its crucial elements.
That's right. And then you supply the emotion, in effect. But the appeal of music on original instruments is one that endlessly fascinates me, precisely because I can't defend it in some way with a real rationale, but I know that it touches me much more deeply than the Otto Klemperer, von Karajan versions of the same music.
Well, let me give you a real rationale from Yo-Yo Ma.
Exactly what I've been waiting for.
Whom we spoke to about the differences between playing Baroque music of the late 17th and early 18th century on a cello of that period versus a modern instrument. Yo-Yo Ma has recorded two albums of music by Bach and others on a Baroque cello. And he had an interesting conversation about those differences between early authentic instruments and the modern versions with WNYC's John Schaefer.
What you see here is Jacqueline Dupré's old Stradivarius, made in 1712, reconstituted into a sort of Baroque instrument. I have got strings on it, and one of a wooden tailpiece, and one of those broader bridges. We didn't go all the way in terms of turning it completely into a Baroque cello, but I think most of the components are there.
Now, the instrument you say was made in 1712.
Yeah.
So that sounds like it's a Baroque instrument to begin with.
Exactly. And what's happened is that in a way, technology has been very influential in making the various changes to a modern old instrument, such as you see here... the A string.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you can see it. It's kind of frayed because I haven't changed it, and it's kind of old. But this is a gut string.
Yeah.
But for a modern cello, you'd put on steel strings, and the difference is on the A string, you can hear a little kind of scraping, reedy sound, which is actually very beautiful.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if the temperature changes too much, if it gets dry, it's much more weather sensitive. It starts squeaking. It's unreliable. It starts to stretch. And, you know, steel is a more durable material. And the demand of larger halls in the 1800s and 1900s has actually asked for greater acoustic sound.
Mm.
I think there is such joy in playing music, noodling. And what's happened is that you have these great instruments that have this, you know, Pavarotti-like voices, and they're designed for large spaces. It's harder to noodle on those instruments. And in a way, what I've discovered with the Baroque instrument is that it's actually a more intimate sound. It's, in many ways, it's suitable for private music making.
Well, chamber music.
Chamber music, smaller rooms.
Now, you mentioned picking up the instrument and noodling. What do you... I mean, when you wake up in the morning and you grab the instrument, what comes to your fingers? Is it Bach?
Often, on this instrument, I would play... It's a wonderful way to wake up. And I have to say also, the strings speak faster. You can do all of these rhythmic bowing changes. The bow, I have to tell you, by the way, this is a Baroque bow.
Uh-huh.
And as you can see, I also brought my
modern
bow. And you can see the difference in the head and the very tip of it.
Mm-hmm.
This one is much heavier.
The modern one,
The modern one. And that allows you to sustain a sound from beginning to end and without a decay. Whereas this bow, which actually my beloved cello teacher, this was Leonard Rose's bow, and he gave it to me, the Baroque bow. And
mm-hmm.
he, when he heard that I was that I'd been interested in it, this is many, many years ago, he said, "What? Take this." And and so I'm playing on it still. But you can see this head, the tip is much, it tapers off. And that and the bow is actually a little shorter, and it allows for just this faster, I think, articulation to take place.
Do you hear a noticeable difference on this instrument when you play the two bows?
Well, here's the modern bow, okay? And the Baroque bow is this one. There's a different kind of breathing.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you that in a funny way, I came to playing the Baroque cello from watching very carefully a really great fiddler and what he did, because that, of course, is also a centuries-old tradition. And in that sense, the change was slower. And because it's an oral tradition, and since we don't have recordings from that era, just watching him gave me the physical feel of what it might be like to play on a Baroque instrument.
Adam Gopnik, now you know, at least in the case of cello, why it is that...
Well, you know, interestingly, real thought takes place sometimes on the air, and I think now I understand the appeal of it to me. And it has to do with something very obvious, which is has to do with the nature that we listen to recorded music. That is to say, generally, generationally, our experience of music, including classical music, is an experience of listening to records in the living room. And if you're listening to records, if you're inviting people over to play in your living room, you sort of don't invite great massed choirs and enormous orchestras. You invite four people over to sing and three people over. You don't want it to be too big in that way. And I think that that function of the way we actually listen to music now probably has as much to do with our liking for that kind of sound that Yo-Yo Ma was describing as any other thing. We don't typically listen to classical music in concert halls. We listen to it in our living rooms.
Well, the next story we're going to hear is about something we can't recreate in our living rooms or in artist studios. On almost every weekend in almost every state, regular people gather to recreate historic battles, especially battles of the Civil War. We asked the novelist Tom Dyja to take a look at this phenomenon for us. Tom's first novel, Play for a Kingdom, was set during the Civil War, and he's finishing up his second novel, in which the main characters are contemporary Civil War reenactors. Tom recently visited a reenactment in Allentown, New Jersey, just outside of Trenton.
Forward, march! One, one, two, one, two.
Once you get into battle and cars are out of your face and you walk into a battlefield scenario, you can lose it, and you can feel the eeriness from time to time in this place.
When I'm out in the field, I am in first person. I am Sergeant Major John Butler, and I am there to kill Yankees, and I am there to protect my generals, and that's exactly what I do.
Hit the stake, Corporal.
The Union troops at Allentown were led by Don Weber, captain of Company K of the 14th New Jersey. He said that when he first reenacted A Day at Gettysburg, he felt transported in time.
I could just imagine seeing these troops, the Confederate troops, coming across that open field, and in some ways imagining the awe that the Union troops felt as these brave men came across this field, knowing that a lot of them were not going to make it.
Encampments like the one in Allentown, though, are really only the top of the reenacting experience. Being able to credibly bring all this history to life for yourself and for your fellow reenactors takes a huge amount of work and research, and people come to it in a lot of different ways. For some, it's the details.
This is what hooked me. I saw this pistol and I bought it, and this is an 1851 Navy Colt revolver, 44 caliber.
Jim Schott does an impression of Sergeant Major John Butler of the 9th Virginia Cavalry. He's a tall man with long, wavy blonde hair and the rakish gray uniform of a Confederate horseman.
All I'm shooting is black powder. Now, would that do some damage to you if you got in front of it?
Other reenactors come to it because they're history buffs, people like Byron Childress of the 3rd Regiment U.S. Colored Troops.
I had been told stories about my ancestry in the Civil War Navy. Of course, when I came up in school, they taught us that black people just sat to the side and waited for Abraham Lincoln's army to come and free the slaves. They never told us about the participation of African Americans in the war, just written right out of the history books.
Usually, reenactors select one real person who served in that regiment and do what's called an impression of them.
They play Sergeant Lawrence from the 2nd Florida.
Through this one person, someone who isn't General Grant or General Lee, they don't just learn facts about the war. They experience what it was like to live in the 1860s as well as what it was like to serve.
What I have on mine is it's been fitted with a telescopic sight because I'm a marksman. Marksmen were not well liked. They weren't considered gentlemen.
Everyone I spoke with wore an incredibly detailed, realistic uniform, from the romantic flash of Jim Schott's high leather boots and long hair to Don Weber's more rumpled Union blues. What they all had in common, though, was that they were created from their intense research.
Yes. We send the boys to get water, and then we heat it over the fire so that we have hot water for dishes.
It looks nice when it's all cleaned up.
Yeah, you know, a lot of work.
It's a lot of work to keep it that way.
At Allentown, there's a Union camp and a Confederate camp, a field of white tents and campfires. The men sit around talking, maybe picking their teeth after breakfast. The women cook and clean. They do some needlework if the other chores are finished. And all throughout the whole encampment, children are wearing 19th century dress and running around, happily playing games that do not involve batteries. Still, with no cell phones, cars, or McDonald's, some people like Byron Childress find that this very different way of life involves no small number of discomforts.
You've got to cook your food over a campfire. You've got to cut or maybe cut and carry the wood. You've got to go get your water in buckets and carry it maybe a quarter of a mile to a half a mile back to camp. It takes you back, and it makes you realize that life was pretty difficult back in those days, and we take a lot for granted now.
For the men of the 3rd Regiment U.S. Colored Troops, like Byron Childress, sitting in a field full of good people who are doing impressions of men and women who would have hated them reveals a complex set of emotions as they reimagine the past. Fred Minus is 1st Sergeant of the 3rd Regiment.
I think what you feel is the hard feelings and the sense of urgency for freedom. These black men that prosecuted this war back in 1863 to 1865, they did not care about their own lives. They were thinking about the lives of their children and their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, and here we stand today as United States Colored Troops, as free citizens in America.
For Studio 360, I'm Thomas Dijah.
It's interesting with Civil War recreations, and in fact, all of the things we've been talking about today, which are sort of a virtual reality. I mean, we talk about virtual reality in the next generation of computer simulations, but it's interesting that in all of these other ways, people have an obsession or at least an interest in imagining that they are someone else doing something in another time.
Yes, that's so. I guess this is the question. Is that a new thing? In other words, is that a particularly new thing, or is that just a function of being alive? That is to say that you always create a golden age that's past. You always wish that you could re-inhabit it. One of the tragedies after all the Civil War was all those guys thought they were fighting the battles out of Sir Walter Scott. They all thought this was going to be gallantry and pageantry, and they didn't understand that it was going to be fought with modern rifles, right, which leave very little room for gallantry and pageantry. So in a weird way, the Civil War fighters were Walter Scott were reenactors themselves. I mean, reenactors with a tragic consequence rather than a comic one. But nonetheless, that urge to refight the last battle, and in fact, not just in the sense of military strategy, but in the deep emotional sense.
Thank you, Adam Gopnik. Thank you for writing Paris to the Moon, which is in bookstores, and for joining us today in Studio 360.
My pleasure.
We're going to finish today's Studio 360 by visiting a master craftsman who uses centuries-old tools to create modern musical instruments. Guy Rebut makes violins and violas in a renovated warehouse here in New York City. Various hardwoods are stacked almost to the ceiling of his converted warehouse to age, and light streams in through the tall windows. And Rebut sits at a work table carving a violin and talking to a customer, violinist Matti Braun from the New York Philharmonic.
I use a set of curved gouges, very, very traditional. This would have been exactly the same kind of tools used 300 years ago. It's important to adhere to traditional methods and use traditional materials so that the result will end up with something which relates to what you're trying to create.
Warmth, brilliance, and different tone colors. That's what I go for. If I get that immediately, then I know that it's a good violin and it keeps my interest.
It's for us to stay within the tradition and show our individual expression in a more of an interpretive way. It's an interpretive craft or an interpretive art, much like playing the violin or playing the cello is. If you're playing Mozart, you have the notes on the page and you stick to the notes pretty much, though the interpretation is can be very much your own.
Although it is new, but some violins you take right away and it feels like you know it.
Anything we do in terms of design, anything you do in terms of successful mechanics has to do with balance and equaling the forces and equaling the energy of the curves and the shapes. And when something is in harmony, in a sense, and in balance, it works well, it looks well, and it sounds well.
Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Michelle Siegel,
Jan Werner,
Lital Molad,
Steve Nelson.
The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC Radio and Public Radio International and is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the David B. Gold Foundation, the Eleanor Naylor Dana Charitable Trust, and the Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, supporting education, the arts, and culture to enrich community life. Special thanks to Susan Morris.
PRI. Public Radio International.
Use the Force, Luke.
It's my world. I'm setting the rules.
You must go now to Delphi and outface him as I did.
Hello, I'm Kurt Anderson. From movie blockbusters to metal music to Richard Wagner, we take a look at how mythology and modern culture collide. Next time in Studio 360. Saturday morning at 10 here on WNYC 93.9 FM.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.